You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting, the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet, chasing bear.
Walking down through here, there's a bunch of dogs free ranging, and we looked down, seen the track, but they took off. Well, we didn't really want all of them to go, but they're gone.
Thanks for checking out the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I want to give a little bit of history, a little bit of background about this podcast and why I was where I was at and what had actually happened. Even that day and the day before, I just got back from being in Eastern Tennessee with Tracy and Ben Jones. They are a father and son that have a long family history of hunting with plots in the Appalachian Mountains for bear. I'd contacted Ben several weeks ago and said, hey, I'd like to film a hound hunt. He said, well, come on. And I said, well, I've got 2 days. And that's a short time to be on a successful hunt. But the day before I left was when they had the massive snowstorm over in Eastern Tennessee and Western North Carolina. We hunted for 2 days and it had some tremendous bear races, and I really got to see some fantastic dog work. And we had a race that started at 10 o'clock in the morning on the first day I was there that lasted until 9 o'clock at night, when Ben went in the dark and pulled his dogs off of a bear that was basically walking on the ground. I was wore to the bone in terms of physical strength. Ben is a mountain man. He's 25 years old, 24, and he, gee whiz, he can walk like a gazelle in the mountains. And I had a hard time, but an awesome time keeping up with him for 2 days. One day, we had that long race. The second day, we started out pretty quick, found a bear 2.5 miles in on foot, leading dogs. We found a bear, and the bear immediately jumped and ran into the bear sanctuary. And so the race ended. We caught the dogs off the bear, and pretty much our hunt was over. Bear hunting with hounds is something that many people don't understand. And if you're listening to this podcast and you've never done it, you probably don't get it. At Bear Hunting Magazine, our desire is to show all aspects of bear hunting. And bear hunting with hounds is the most traditional method to hunt bear in North America. All these guys, Daniel Boone hunted with hounds. A lot of historical hunters hunted with hounds. North Carolina, the state dog is the plot hound. The plot hound was developed in the Appalachian Mountains, and its identity was formed around bear hunting. It's a super small world. It's a small niche of people that are committed to this, really, lifestyle. You can't just have a bear hound. You can't just have two bear hounds. If you're going to be a serious bear hunter, you got to have a pack of hounds. It's a year-round process. It's expensive. And these guys devote a big section of their life to training and raising bear hounds. And a bear hound is an exceptional animal that has to have a unique set of characteristics. I mean, just really make it an exceptional animal. Somebody that didn't know might look out into the backyard of some bear hunter and see what their eyes perceive as a rough-looking old hound. But let me tell you, if you really knew what that was, you'd look at that hound and you'd say, my goodness, that is an exceptional animal that has been bred for nose, for speed, for athleticism, for fearlessness. It's been bred for trainability and loyalty. It's been bred to have good, solid feet so it can run for days and days. It's been bred for grit, the desire to and the courage to stay on a bear when a bear turns to fight. There's a lot of things that have to happen. So the bear hound world is extremely complex and hard to understand. And here's the most important thing. The bear hound world, and bear hunting with hounds, is the lowest hanging fruit. And I want to tell you why it's important to you. If you don't even hunt with hounds and don't care to hunt with hounds, and maybe you don't even like hounds, but if you're a hunter and you want to continue to see our freedoms as hunters in the modern age continue, I will tell you that bear hunting with hounds is the low-hanging fruit for the anti-hunting community in this country, in this world, and their desire is to pick it off and to absolutely extinguish it. Why does that matter to the guy that doesn't even like hound hunting? Is because in the long game, and that's where we've all got to turn our eyes towards, is the long game. If we truly are concerned about the freedoms that our sons and daughters and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will have long after we are gone, should this earth persist, is that we got to play the long game. And in the long game, if they pick off the low-hanging fruit, then all of a sudden, the next rung up the ladder is the low-hanging fruit. And they'll be after something next. And the anti-hunting community has a strategy of incrementalism. They want to pick us off one section at a time. And eventually, there'll be a generation of people that wake up and will be like Europe, and where people can run around and hunt game birds raised on a farm. And the very thing that has given American hunters the identity that we have and the freedoms that we have, and the very thing that has made wildlife thrive in this country more than any other place on the planet, North American model for wildlife conservation, is the most successful model of wildlife conservation ever in the history of man. We have more big game than any place on the planet, and it's because of conservation-minded hunters. And bear hunting with hounds is a tool used by bear managers to harvest bear in a regulated way. And even if you don't like hound hunting, even if you've been offended by hound hunters in states that you live, I petition you to give them a chance. And just out of principle, support hound hunting. And I also implore the hound hunters to be respectful, to respect property boundaries, and to respect other hunters in the woods, and to, you know, clean up their game in a lot of ways. If we can all stand in unification in these certain areas, it's going to mean a lot. So hey, that's a quick commentary on why this matters to someone who's not a hound hunter. I think you're going to enjoy this podcast. You're going to learn a lot about bear hounds. You're going to learn about the history of bear hunting in the Appalachian Mountains. And I had a great conversation with Tracy Jones. Enjoy. All right. Welcome to the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I am in Greenville, Tennessee. Not Greenville, Tennessee proper, though. We're outside of Greenville, Tennessee. Yeah. 10 miles?
Yep, about 10 miles south of Greenville.
Okay. And I have been bear hunting with TL and Ben Jones for the last 2 days. I kind of put them in a bind. I talked to him about 3 weeks ago, talked to Ben, and I'm going to introduce who these guys are. I've got TL with me here, but about 3 weeks ago, I guess I'd contacted you guys and said, I want to do a bear hunt in the Appalachians, and you guys were hospitable enough to let me come up and hunt, but I only had 2 days. And then the day before I got here, we had this real bad snow, which, according to y'all, could have been good, could have been bad. And but I came up here, and man, I've had an awesome time. I really have. So thank you so much. Who I've got here in front of me is Tracy Jones. And so Tracy is Tracy's a pastor here and bear hunter. Tracy, introduce yourself.
My son and I live in Greene County, Tennessee. My papaw, a lot of people knew him, Barry Tarleton. He's well known with plot people. And then my dad, Terry Jones, was a bear hunter in plots. And I have several other family members that were really good bear hunters and plot men. My cousin, Charles Lowry, and my cousin, Rocky Lowry. And it's just always been a, you know, a family thing, and a lot of friends around us too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you guys have been hunting plots since the 1950s, when Barry Tarleton, your grandfather, started getting plots.
Yeah, we don't know the exact date that he got his first plot. My cousin Charles got a puppy from him in 1965, so we know it predates 1965. Papa went on a bear hunt with Von Plott, and if I remember correctly, it was down in Gatlinburg, before Gatlinburg was really commercialized. And sometime during that hunt, Von Plott just convinced my grandpa, who was hunting different things. He coon hunted mostly and had started treeing some bear at night. Wanted to bear hunt, and Von talked him into giving plots a try, but then he wouldn't sell him a dog. And so my papa started looking around trying to find a plot, and I'm not exactly sure where he got his first one at. I don't think he really remembered where the first one came from. Early on, he did get a plot out of Kentucky from a man named Benny Moore, but I don't think that was the first one, but that was an earlier one.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the strain of dogs that came from Barry and Charles Lowry is this Houston Valley line.
Yeah. Like I said, we know that he had a litter of pups in 65. I don't know what those dogs were exactly. Where the Houston Valley line really got its start was in the early 70s. Papaw got a female pup from Gene White, who had White Holla plots, and they were very close friends. And if you look at the paperwork, Gene basically was just getting started in plots too. And Gene had got the White Holla Jr. dog, and it was out of some Kermit Allison dogs and I think some Weems bred dogs. And White Holla Jr. was a dog my papa really thought a lot of. He hunted with him several times up in Canada. And this female pup my papa got, her name was Jap. She got hurt and was physically unable to keep bear hunting, so he went back to Gene, and they did a pup swap. And Gene kept the Jap dog, and my papaw got a dog that is called, on her papers, her name was Roberta. They called her Polly around the house. But Roberta became the foundation of Houston Valley Plots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to even jump in and describe some of the kind of a strain of hounds. I think some people that listen to this may not be real familiar with hounds and even hound hunting over here. And so what seems to have happened, and Tracy, tell me if this is accurate, is that in these mountains there would be guys that started bear hunting. They started getting good dogs. And they bred good dogs to good dogs. And they typically, these mountain people wanted to keep, they wanted to keep dogs in the hands of family and in the hands of loyal friends and keep them pretty tight-knit for many reasons, one of which would be that if you sold dogs or sent dogs way off, if it was the best dog in the world, you wouldn't really be able to have that much access to breed back into it. But these guys wanted to keep their good dogs pretty tight, and there's these, so in the different breeds, and especially the plot breed, there's these pretty tight strains of plots. So they're all registered plot hounds. I mean, so there's it's a breed just like a American Border Collie. I mean, you know, plot hound. But inside of the plot hound, it's almost like there's these real tight strains, and Houston Valley's one of them, and there's all these others too.
Right.
But to me, that's really neat, because just the culture and the long-standing history of breeding. I mean, you could look back at papers on your dogs and you hunted with a lot of those dogs, and then before you were born probably there was a lot of dogs, but you would know the history of those dogs, you would know the characteristics of those dogs. And so what you've got 60 years into this tight blind bred in some cases strain of dogs is something that's really predictable from a breeding standpoint, and that it's going to be, I mean, you breed dogs, they're not all going to be perfect, but you know what you're getting.
Right. Our pups right now, depending on what females bred to what male, go back about, I think, 12 generations to Roberta. And almost every dog that we've bred that we have now goes back to Roberta. And so, you know, that's our foundation that we work from. And the Jap dog actually became foundational for Jean's dogs. And I think she was also really foundational for some of the Polly dogs out of Michigan, too, the Jap dog was, and some other folks. And then later on, Steve Fielder ended up with a pup out of the Roberta dog in Big Timber. A lot of people are familiar with Cascade Big Timber. And the Bronco dog was really important in his breeding program. So the Roberta dog has a lot of influence in the plot breed that I guess some folks wouldn't pay attention to. You know, my grandfather, my papa was never into advertising. And but in reference to the family type thing, I won't delve into plot history because even among hardcore plot people, that's so controversial. That I just don't want in the middle that there's basically two theories when you boil it all down to the bottom line. One is pretty much the Plott brothers came over from Germany and they were never outcrossed on anything whatsoever and bred down with the family.
Right.
The other theory
and what you're talking about is the origins of the Plott breed, which
would have come from Germany pretty much eventually into North Carolina, and then specifically to Western North Carolina, into Plott Balsam.
Right.
And then would have been filtered out.
Plott Balsam is a place.
It's a place.
It's a valley.
Yeah. And then the Plotts would have been filtered out from Plott Balsam, you know, pretty much around the globe now.
Yeah.
And
they're the only, let me say, and again, if somebody that's listening to this that knows Plotts, this is stuff that they know, or bear hounds.
Sure.
But for somebody that doesn't have any context for that, the Plott Hound is the only hound that wasn't bred from like European foxhounds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And they were bred from German big game dogs. Basically.
Yeah.
And the unique thing about Plotts is that they were known as bear dogs. So in the bear dog world, there's all these different breeds of hounds from Walker, Redbone, Blue Tick, English, Black and Tan. There's all these different breeds, which all those breeds were descendants of European foxhounds. The Plott was different. And all those breeds make fine bear dogs in different strains, for sure. And people use them all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
But what's cool to me about the Plotts is they were known and developed their identity as bear dogs.
Sure. Well, I don't consider myself a Plott historian at all. You know, men like John Jackson and Bob Plott have written extensively on that subject,
right.
And that would be the go-to people there. But
yeah.
But you have the theory that the Plott brothers, you know, came from Germany, and they would have been basically pure down through the family lines until they started filtering out to others. And some men still, you know, view their particular strain as going back to the originals. The second theory, you know, just basic fundamentally with a lot of twists and turns, would be that along the way the Plott had X dog added to it here, X dog added
right.
to it there. Then that's where the sort of the disagreements among the Plott historians come in. And I was raised with mountain people. And in an isolated location, it would be hard for me to believe that at some point a mountain family didn't add something here or something there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even something accidental that bred one of these dogs.
And I wouldn't, you know, fight that with somebody that has the purest, you know, theory. But mountain people are pragmatic people because, honestly, because of poverty.
Yeah.
And they couldn't afford to keep a dog that didn't carry its weight.
Yeah.
And they couldn't keep, you have to keep a lot of dogs. If you want a line of hounds and you only want your own name on the paperwork, in other words, every dog on that paperwork is yours and you're the only one, nobody else has any influence in your dog's dog, you have to keep a lot of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of dogs.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, this discussion came up really this week through a Facebook post. Somebody had asked the question, you know, where are the plots that are strictly line bred with no outside influences? And the best answer to that question came from Ray Brown. And, you know, Ray is a very well-known, well-respected bear hunter and plot man. And Ray said it's not that nobody is breeding line bred dogs. It's that it's a family of dogs a lot of people stick with. In other words, it may have come from the same source, but the name on it will be Brown, or the name will be Weems, or the name will be Tarleton, or the name will be Lowry, and so on. But if you go back far enough, it comes from the same source.
They all came from the same place.
Yeah, and there was very few originally registered plots that these things come out, flow out of.
Well, the plot breed didn't become an official registered UKC breed until, I think, 1948.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's relatively new that these dogs have had papers kept. And I know there's historical records of the plots keeping records of dogs and breeding and different stuff. But let me take the conversation this way. I would like for you to describe and envision somebody that didn't know bear dogs, characteristics of a bear dog. Because, or what you're looking for in a dog. Because to me, my history with hounds originally started with coon hunting when I was in high school. I had dogs for several years and really learned to love and appreciate the hound sports. We never even dreamt of running bear with these hounds. We just didn't. And when I started understanding bear hounds, I realized that this is really an elite animal that's being bred. And I believe I heard Steve Hurd said it in an article in Bear Hunting Magazine, that he said of all the animals that man has put his fingerprint of influence on in breeding, from cattle to horses to anything, he felt like that there was more things that had to line up right for a bear dog than just about anything. And it was an interesting statement, because he talked about a dog's got to have a super good nose. A dog's got to be a super athlete to be able to run and chase these bears. I mean, we've been in these mountains, I mean, steep as a cow's face, and these dogs put on 12, 13 miles yesterday. I don't know. I mean, running straight up and down in
snow.
In
snow and ice. Yeah.
Right. So they got to have an incredible nose, which not every hound has. The variance in a hound's nose is a broad spectrum. Some can smell this amount of scent, and some can smell this. So, you know, nose, athleticism, treeing. When you're running big game that trees, and again, this is for someone who doesn't know this sport, a dog, there are running dogs that all they want to do is run game. Mm-hmm. And when that game goes up a tree, they'd be done.
They're done.
But a tree dog has got to have that instinct to run the game. And when it goes up a tree, he's got to have the instinct to sit there and bark, I mean, until his master gets there, until that animal comes down out of the tree. And so that takes a really special animal, and that's bred in. I mean, even to this day, inside of good bear dog lines, there are dogs that aren't good tree dogs. Maybe they'll run a bear, but they're, you know, they get to the tree, they're not that interested. So that's a dog that is not bred and is kind of left out of the breeding program probably in the future. But point being, there's a lot of things. What are you guys after in these Tennessee mountains? What do you need a dog? What are the key characteristics?
Well, before I start, you're asking for a matter of opinion.
That's
right. And if you ask, you know, 100 bear hunters, you are going to get variations.
Yeah.
But for us, I think you start at the finish line and then work backwards in breeding.
Okay.
Instead of looking at the dog and looking at its paperwork, if you're considering it for breeding, you need to look at the finish line. In other words, the most important thing about a big game hound is, does it produce big game? And all the other variables lead to that. But you don't want pieces to a clock. You want to know what time it is.
Right. And you mean you want to be able to catch game, tree game.
That's right.
Yep.
If the dog is not a game catcher and it's not showing up on the end.
Yep.
Something's missing. Something's not there. So producing game is it. You know, the coon hunters, like, they have a big argument going on now about dogs that slick tree a lot.
Right.
Well, if you're playing a points game, some of that can be overlooked, I guess.
Yes.
But if you're walking 5 or 6 hours in the mountains to a dog that has nothing,
that's a big deal.
It's pointless.
Yeah.
There's no points up there. There's no scorecard. Does that make sense to
you? Absolutely.
So producing is the number one.
And what you're describing too is a dog that just has a natural ability. I mean, inside of you turn out 10 bear dogs, there's going to be percentage of those dogs that just time after time after time. And when you say get to the finish line, what you mean is at the bottom of a bear tree. Mm-hmm. Or have a bear bait up or whatever. Yep. It takes. I mean,
or even cross into the sanctuary like today with it. I mean, that's not that dog's fault that there's an imaginary line there.
Right.
Yeah.
What he's talking about is today we had a really good bear race. We jumped a bear in a good spot, and the bear headed and crossed a road and went into an area that we couldn't hunt. And so they caught the dogs off the track. But if we'd have been able to run that bear, we probably would have got him. But we had to pull him off. But
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the traits that lead to the finish line, in my personal opinion, my viewpoint, right at, if not at the top of the list, right at the top of the list is drive, desire.
Hmm.
Because a house dog is extremely intelligent. Some of them are. Bird dogs, some of those, one of the smartest dogs I ever worked with was an English pointer. But neither the house dog or the English pointer will run a bear.
That's right.
But there has to be that innate desire that when it gets that scent of bear, for whatever reason in that DNA code, it runs it.
Mm-hmm.
And it don't want to stop until it's over. Treed, bayed, caught off, or whatever.
Yeah.
So some people call it desire. Some people call it drive. Some people call it heart. It doesn't matter how smart a dog is if it has no drive. It doesn't matter how good of a nose it has if it doesn't have any drive. To me, drive or heart is the engine that everything else is built around.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of one dog that I had that wasn't the grittiest dog. He wasn't the fastest dog. He didn't have a super cold nose, but anything I turned him on, whatever it was, he just had no quit. And so he made up for a lot of not what I would call faults, because he was sufficient.
Right.
He just wasn't exceptional.
Yeah.
But except for one area, and that was in drive.
Hmm.
And he was one of the favorite dogs I ever had. He wasn't flashy. Nobody knows his name, but if you turned him on something, he meant to catch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that statement can be qualified, too, by saying or describing. I think people that have never bear hunted with hounds don't realize how intense it is to tree or catch a bear. I mean, like, you turn 10 dogs loose on a red-hot bear track, and that bear runs for 12 miles in these mountains. There's going to be some dogs that drop out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some dogs that end up back at the truck.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some dogs that end up sleeping on the side of the mountain because they just lay down. I mean, it's it happens. And that happens to good dogs too. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables to that.
Many. Yeah. But the point being, there's certainly some dogs that don't have the drive that others do.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's what you're looking for.
To me, that's the number one quality. And without it, you have no framework to build around.
Yeah. That's probably a good quality of humans too, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
You can make up for a lot of stuff if you got a little bit of drive and desire.
Well, I grew up in the time frame when boxing was something that men watched a lot. It wasn't on pay-per-view. It was a national sport. Everybody, the names of boxers were household names. You know, everybody knew the people who were going to fight. And it was on regular TV, and people would gather up in their living rooms and watch a match. But I bring that up to say it's impossible to whip somebody who won't quit. And a dog that just will not quit is pretty hard to beat.
Yeah. What would be – okay, so if we were going back from the finish line backwards, that desire would be a number one trait. What would be some of the other traits that you'd look for in a hound?
Well, if a dog is exceptionally intelligent, I think that's where some of your better trail dogs come from.
Okay.
You know, a dog can be an asset as a bear dog and not be your main trail dog.
Tell us what a trail dog is.
Well, when somebody gets ready to start a bear race, normally they'll have a particular dog or dogs that they count on to start the track and trail it up when the conditions are not real good and get it jumped as the other dogs come along behind, with the idea the trail dog gets the bear up and running as the other dogs catch them from behind. And you know, different people, different areas hunt different ways, but traditionally through the mountains here, men would have a dog or dog that was their primary trail dog, and then the other dogs would take some place in their pack, you know, some value somewhere.
Right.
It's not that the other dogs couldn't run a track, but they're just something that separates a real top-notch trail dog apart, and I think intelligence plays a role in that. If a dog's, you know, if he has a mind to figure things out, like you'll see dogs sometimes even running a bear that's already jumped, and they'll get in some rocks. And for whatever reason, one dog will go right on through the rocks, just lickety-split. And another two or three dogs get hung up at the same place the other one went through and can't figure out how to go across.
Right.
Well, there's a reason that one dog goes through.
Yeah.
He has the mental capacity to figure out how to make it.
Right. Or he, at one time, maybe prior in his life, he figured it out once, and so he had the intelligence to figure it out again.
Yeah.
And maybe he just stumbled on it the first time, you know?
Yeah. Yep. So intelligence, I think, is a factor there. And then, of course, the obvious things like endurance and stamina and how long they can go.
That right there, to me, as somebody who hadn't had a ton of history with bear hounds until the last 5 years, that's what blows my mind is the athleticism and endurance that these dogs have to have. I have so much respect for bears, and I think bear hunters, guys that bear hunt with hounds, have a whole different kind of respect in terms of these bears can run and run and run and run straight up and down mountains. I mean, these mountains we were in today and yesterday, just unbelievable. So it takes a heck of an animal to overcome that.
Yeah. There's a misperception among non-hunters and a misperception among some hunters that using hounds isn't fair chase. And nothing can be further from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, a bear is fully aware that he's being chased. Whereas other methods, which I'm not opposed to other methods,
sure.
Legal methods, do it.
Yeah.
But other methods, that bear may not even be aware you're anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And then he's dead.
Yeah.
With the hounds, he has everything at his disposal. You're on his turf, you're on his home ground. He lives there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He knows where everything's at. They have, according to some research I've read, they really have a mapping capacity to remember where they've been and how things lay. They just have all the advantages. And a dog with endurance, you know, gives you an advantage. I mean, like you said, they're incredible athletes.
And so that endurance would play out in actual practical terms with having dogs that had really good feet. Like, and dog people probably wouldn't, or someone who wasn't a dog person might not understand that, but these dogs run so far, running in rough terrain, rocky terrain, snowy terrain. They've got to have genetically predisposed feet that are tight, that their pads are thick, that they're, you know, one of the guys we were hunting with today, Pat, was showing me one of his dog's feet, and that dog had hair that kind of grew over the edge of the pads. In his mind, that was a good trait that made it had tough feet, you know. And not all dogs are going to be that way, but got to have tough feet, got to have, for this endurance, trim dogs. I mean, these aren't big hounds. A lot of people would think bear hound, big hound. I mean, what would be the bandwidth of weight for Houston Valley Plots?
Well, for our dogs, I prefer a male dog that doesn't go over, you know, 50 or 55 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And a female, I prefer not to go over 45 or 50 pounds.
Yeah.
And, but then again, you know, a dog being a little larger than that or a little smaller than that is not always a determining factor of its endurance.
True.
Or its drive.
Right, right.
You know, sometimes a bigger dog that you wouldn't think could carry himself can run all day.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
But that size.
That size, yeah.
Is usually pretty good for a dog being able to run day after day after day and not break down.
Yeah.
I mean, typically a bigger hound is going to break down a little faster. And by that, I mean, these guys are hunting. I mean, I think Ben said he's hunted every day since Thanksgiving. And it's December the 13th or 14th today.
Well, you know, the more weight a dog carries and the bigger he gets, there's so many factors. At some point, there's a breaking point there where that's just too big.
Yeah, yeah.
He may keep up for an hour, or he might keep up for 2 hours. But that great big, you know, 8,500-pound dog, generally speaking, in the mountains, is not going to be an all-day dog.
Yeah.
Now, somebody listening somewhere is going to say, oh, yes, I had old Rufus, and he weighed 150 pounds and could run for 4 days straight, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But Rufus is an outlier. He's an exception to the rule.
I've found that amongst the bear hound guys that I've run into is that they typically like the smaller dogs.
Yeah.
And even in long legs doesn't equate to speed.
No.
Because on a track, it's not when you – well, that brings us into another characteristic, Tracy, that I think is – I know you're going to list, is that you're looking for a dog that's got speed. Just to talk about that. Well, what I was going to say was that speed doesn't come from having long legs or short legs. Speed comes from – being able to navigate scent and move through that scent, track it with its head up, you know.
Well, the discussion we're having right now about traits you like seems to be I'm not sure you would call it a cyclical thing, but there seems to be different factors during different time periods that everybody's after.
Okay.
I can remember years ago that everybody wanted something more gritty.
Yes.
And they started trying to breed. I've seen them even try to breed pit bull into the hounds, and that was a huge train wreck because the dogs would get to the tree, and that desire to catch something didn't stop at the tree. And they'd catch other dogs.
Mm.
That was a terrible train wreck here locally.
Mm.
Then nose is something that seems to be something that points in time everybody's trying to find more nose, more tracking ability, more trailing ability.
Yeah.
And then recently there's been a lot of talk, well, at least among people that I'm familiar with, about speed. I want to be faster. And fast is good. But when you, and Ben and I have discussed this, when you look at a hound's physical makeup, it's only going to be able to go so fast because of the way it's built. If you put that in horse terms, there's a reason that the records in the Kentucky Derby and some of the other horse races are seldom broken.
Right.
Because no matter how much money a billionaire has, and no matter how much access he has to the best trainers, and no matter how much access he has to everything he could possibly need to breed a faster horse, it genetically cannot be done.
Right.
It tops out.
Yeah.
And a hound's the same way. They can only get so fast.
Right. In terms of just like foot speed in a race.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have hounds that are fast enough to produce, to me they're fast enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fast enough to catch game.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're catching what you want to catch, you have enough speed.
Yeah. And I think too that may, you know, what I've seen in different places is that I've heard somebody say speed kills, talking about just an animal being able to track fast enough that they just gain on a bear. I mean, a bear is laying in its bed. He hears a hound, 500 yards away, open, and he goes, "Man, I wonder if that hound's coming after me." He doesn't actually think that, but and the hound's getting closer. Finally, that hound comes within range of threatening that bear. The bear takes off running. Well, the ability of that hound to pick up that scent and overcome that bear. And again, it's not foot speed, but it's the ability for that hound to navigate the scent, navigate the terrain,
Well, I mean, the bottom line is the dog's got to be fast enough to run the bear down and either stop it or make it so uncomfortable it goes up a tree.
Yeah, yeah.
So the dog has to be faster than the bear.
He's got to be.
Yep.
Yep. Got to be. Well, and like you said today, or like you said a little bit ago, this hound hunting is not a given. I've been here 2 days, and we've yet to see a bear in a tree. We've been met with tough conditions, but before I got here, you guys were treeing bears, and I'm sure as soon as I leave this afternoon, y'all are going to tree bears tomorrow. But it's tough. I mean, we ran a bear yesterday for miles.
Well, the race yesterday. What, you turn loose at 9 o'clock or so? I'm not sure.
That's about right.
And the last dogs were pulled off of it well after dark.
Yeah. Yep. So they're tough. Super tough.
Yeah.
And it really is a fair chase hunt. I mean, when you look at it that way.
But I don't get excited. I mean, you've been here 2 days. We had one race that lasted all day. We didn't kill it. Another one today that we run got off into the sanctuary, which is, an imaginary line between where you're allowed to kill and where you're not.
Right.
But I don't get excited about that because, I mean, we've did this so long. I mean, the bottom line is sometimes the bear win.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, what would be the point?
Yep.
Yeah.
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 They do win sometimes.
They do win sometimes. And I think that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah, it is.
And you say, well, if you had better dogs, you would have won. Well, I'm no expert, but I've seen a few bear dogs, and maybe somebody had a dog somewhere that if we'd had it here yesterday, it would have made a difference. But
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't think
If it's out there, there's some people with some great dogs, but if dogs run one all day long, just how much more can you ask?
Right. I sit in a unique position at Bear Hunting Magazine, and I've made some. I have been for somebody that's not been in the bear hound world very long. I've had the opportunity to hunt with some great bear houndsmen all over the country, And I can tell you, they all get beat.
Sure, they do.
They really do.
Absolutely.
I mean, you see, obviously, you're not going to post a picture on Facebook of a, you know, back of your truck empty and say, you know, there's no bear. I mean, you hear the good stories. You hear the times when the dogs did great. And if you're closer to these people, obviously you hear the good and the bad.
Well, you and I are friends on Facebook, and I enjoy social media because I like to see what other people's doing hunting and other things. Sometimes I do purposely put on social media, bears one, us zero. Or the bear won today. Or
yeah,
got
you
away.
Would do that.
I do that.
Yeah.
Because I laugh about it. I don't, if the dogs were junk and we could never catch anything, I wouldn't be laughing.
Yeah.
But I just know we got beat.
Yeah.
And if you get beat by a great opponent,
there's some honor in that.
There's no defeat in that.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that. I enjoy the aspect that it's not a give me. And it's a good day to me if you're out there and you run up on an opponent that, you know, it's a worthy opponent, you know. If you turn a dog loose every time you turn it loose and the bear just popped up a tree, I would grow weary of that. I'd grow tired of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the biggest just you talking about being able to be content inside of, you know, not treeing a bear and it being difficult. You know, you grew up in these mountains in a time when it was really hard to tree a bear because there weren't as many here.
Yeah.
We're living, and I asked you yesterday, I said, are you in the heyday of bears in the Appalachian Mountains? And there's probably different answers to that, but no doubt there's a lot of bears here and a lot more than there used to be.
Yeah. When I was a kid growing up, there was times when we might not find a bear for 2 or 3 days to even turn a dog loose on. And so, yeah, there's a lot more bear now than there was then. The trade-off is we're pinched a little tighter. There's still as much national forest, but they've closed all the gates pretty much. There's very few roads to drive, so access is foot only.
Yeah.
And I know to some people that seems like it would make it more fair to the bears, but the problem is as you get older, there's not too many people past, say, 50 or 55 that can still handle the mountains with any speed anymore.
Yeah.
You know, about dog speed. I mean, the hunter's got to go there, too. Wherever the dog goes, you don't walk with the dog track for track.
That's right.
But the end game is you got to be wherever he stops.
Yeah.
And we had a lot more access to the mountains when I was a boy to be able to get certain places. And then so many people have moved in around the foot of the mountain from other areas that don't understand our culture, don't understand our history, have no clue what we're doing.
Right.
And they'll buy, say, maybe an acre or 2 acres, and then they don't want anybody within earshot of them doing anything.
Right.
That they don't quite understand. Whereas years ago, you knew everybody.
Yeah.
Or if you didn't know them, some guy you were with knew them. And so we've sort of traded out. We got more bear, but less access.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense to you.
That's a great description of it, I think.
Yeah.
And they've, you know, you talked to me the other day about bear sanctuaries, and that's a pretty neat concept. So in Tennessee, just to give a very general description of the bear sanctuary is they've got all this national forest, massive amounts of national forest, and they've blocked off these huge sections. I mean, like thousands and thousands of acres that they say, okay, this is a bear sanctuary. So you can hunt bear here, you can hunt bear here, but you can't hunt bear here. And you can hunt other stuff there. You can hunt deer there. You can hunt coon there. You can do other stuff. And what these bear sanctuaries have done is help the bears, you feel like.
Well, I would like to talk about that. And let me begin by saying on this subject that I personally appreciate what the TWRA has done, say, since the mid-60s. Now, I could be off a little bit in my timing of when their program started and so forth.
Right.
But from the mid-60s, which is just a little bit before I was born, up through the mid-70s when I was a kid, they wanted to get the bear numbers up. And they implemented what I call a three-pronged strategy. I don't know what's on their paperwork at the TWRA, but from a hunter's perspective, it was this way. Number one, we only had one short kill season, and there was, I think, 2 weeks in December. It was usually like December 1st to December the 14th kind of a deal. And when you had a short kill season, obviously less bear kill. Number two, it was always a late season. And the idea behind it was that bred sows would be laid up.
Yeah.
So you kill less sows. So yeah, that helped with numbers. Then the third prong of that strategy was the bear reserves.
Yeah.
And when I was a little kid, I can still remember riding with my papaw around the bear sanctuary where the bear we put into today. Yes. I rode with him and actually nailed up the sanctuary signs around that sanctuary. Mm. That are, some of them are still there. They're little triangles. Mm. And they're still there today. Well, the TWRA, several years ago now, I'm going to say pushing 10 years, decided that they wanted the bear numbers to be lowered. There was too many bear. Now, we have argued over that. Obviously, there are more bear, but that's a different discussion than whether too many bear.
Right.
So the TWRA came up with the term cultural carrying capacity. Mm-hmm. And when I began to look into that, they did an article on it in their magazine about cultural carrying capacity. And basically, that means there are too many bear close to too many people.
The amount of a certain species of wildlife that the human population will tolerate.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cultural now, tolerance. Yeah.
Right. Now, we have a good regional director here where we're at. I like him a lot. I know the biologist. He works hard. But that term cultural carrying capacity and then an article in the magazine implied that bear was just way overpopulated and need to be severely reduced. And they began to implement plans to do that. So I asked them the question, the director and the biologist, what do you have a, how many, I asked them how many bear are in the state of Tennessee. Well, obviously they don't know how many total bear are here and there's no way to know. But they go off based off, from what I can tell, primarily complaints that are called in that the wardens have to go answer. And then they had a research method where they would take sardine cans and string them down through a certain area.
Yes.
And however many cans were hit, they sort of tabulated the bear population.
Extrapolate general population numbers from that.
One bear can hit all those cans in a night.
Yeah.
So, or two bear can hit all those cans. But you can't say 10 hit cans equals 10 bear or whatever. It's, yeah. There are a lot of factors there. The bottom line is we don't know exactly the total number of bear in Tennessee. You could not know. They have started a new research method where they put up barbed wire fence type enclosures. And as the bear go in to get food, it pulls hair out. And they use that as samples. That's probably more accurate.
Yeah.
And personally, I don't go along with the idea that there are too many bear.
Yeah.
But they implemented this thing where they brought in a lot more bow season, and I'm not against people bow hunting. They brought in shooting bear during deer season, you know, just if it passed by your tree stand kind of thing. They implemented longer hound seasons. The hound people really didn't want to kill that many more bear, but pretty much if we weren't willing to kill them, they were going to get somebody else to.
I see.
Because they wanted the numbers lowered, period.
Yeah.
So I guess the point being, yes, there are a lot more bear than there used to be, but I doubt there'll ever be too many bear for a bear hunter.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. You know, I think it's so interesting, and so this really shows the heart of the modern conservation hunter is that we want wildlife to thrive.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. we are the best friend of bear.
Well, the three-pronged plan that we were talking about, they've done away with short seasons because we have extremely long seasons now for kill.
Right.
And they've done away with having only a late season because we're starting all the way in October now. So the only prong of that plan left is the sanctuaries.
Right.
And I've heard talk recently that they want to do away with the sanctuaries, which I hope they never do.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to say something here. I'm not a biologist. I don't pretend to be one, and I didn't sleep at a Holiday Inn last night. But from what I've read, sows like to go back and raise where they were born. Same general area.
Yeah.
I believe one of the reasons we have a stable bear population is because the bears that are actually being born and raised are generational from the same places.
Right.
And what we're killing is the overflow out of the sanctuaries.
Yeah.
If you take away the sanctuaries, more or less what you'll do is end up harassing bear in every location, where how can anything ever be a traditional ground to raise the little ones? What can they ever go back to? Where can they get away from being run or treed or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I think those sows need places that they can go back to that they're familiar with and raise their little ones where there's no encroachment at all.
Right. Yeah. And so, again, a hound hunter saying, keep the sanctuaries.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, a hound hunter saying, let's limit ourselves and say, we will not kill bear in this big section of ground. And I mean, that those sanctuaries cost us a bear today.
Yeah.
And you guys are
I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
The bear won.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just catch your dogs off of it and laugh and give him a thumbs up.
Yep.
Yep. You beat us today. We'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
And you know, so, I mean, I thought about it in these terms. If the way I view it is correct and you're having generational den sites or den areas where sows raise their little ones, if my grandfather was running those bear in the late 50s, mid 60s, with plots, and now here I'm up in, and me, my cousin Charles, my cousin Rocky, my cousin Terry, other family members, friends that we've had for years, our dogs are 12 generations, and to me, it's there's a lot of Appalachian, I don't know if pride is the word for it, but there's a lot of historical satisfaction for me to think that my dogs go back 12 generations to where we got started, and the bear we're running are still the same offspring of the bear those dogs were running.
Mm, mm. And you're running them in the same places.
Same places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was really neat this week to hear you, Ben's commentary and your commentary just on this area you're hunting. I mean, really, if you think, I mean, you've been hunting bears since you were a kid. I mean, decades of even that same mountain. I mean, you guys mm-hmm. have probably treed bears all over that mountain, had races all over it. Your grandfather, you live in this valley, but, you know, you just got so much history here. That's not normal. I mean, most people, yeah. I mean, I think that's something that's unique to this region of the country too, is that I don't see this in Arkansas.
Well, Papaw's family came, the Tarletons came in the mid 1800s, and my dad's side of the family, the Reeves side, his mother's side, came in very similar along the time that the Crocketts came here. Davy Crockett's family, Davy Crockett was born in this same county where we're at here in Greene County.
Mm.
And his family owned a mill just about 3 or 4 miles over here on a creek going in the river. Mm. And when the Crockett people come in, it was a very similar time that my dad's family came in. So, yeah, I mean, we've been here generation after generation after generation.
Yeah.
And a lot of history and a lot of tradition. But like we were discussing earlier, some traditions are really good.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I want to give you an opportunity before we end to just say whatever you want about bear dogs and bear hunting. But before we do that, you told me some neat stories, and I'm trying to, you told me some neat stories about your grandfather. Tell the story about him coming into town. This isn't related to bear hunting, but this is just.
Well, our strain of plots, Houston Valley plots, originated out of where my grandfather was born. He was born in Houston Valley.
So Houston Valley's a place.
Yes, it's a place. He was born there, and he was 13 years old before he ever went to Greenville for the first time. All he had ever been to was a little country stores. And he said he was shocked when he got to Greenville because in his mind, town was just a very large building, a bigger country store. He just thought he was going to a bigger store.
Bigger store.
And he said he couldn't believe all the buildings in town.
Huh.
Yeah. 13 years old, rode in a wagon.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yep.
That's amazing. Any other neat family stories? You've told me some that as you were telling me, I was like, I wish I could have recorded that. I can't think of what exactly offhand, but I remember when you told me that, I was like 13 years old before he ever went into town.
Yep.
And that was just right down here. This place was really geographically isolated. The mountains kind of just isolated people. Well, you told me this. You said the rich people lived down in the river bottoms. The poor people lived up in these mountains. And
that's the ironic thing today about how expensive the mountain land is.
Yeah.
A local kid who wants to live here and work here and stay here, he can't even afford to buy a piece of property hardly anymore.
Right.
But the reason his ancestors were here is because nobody else literally wanted it.
Yeah. And so now people are wanting to live in the mountains just for the recreational, just the aesthetics. Yep. I mean, these mountains are spectacular.
Well, it was the worst ground possible for a farmer. I mean,
you know, it goes to show you just how much our value system has changed, and this is just progression of society, I suspect. But I mean, there was a time when aesthetics meant nothing. My dad's 70 years old, and he tells me, he said, Clay, we used to not talk about views and, you know, in terms of land. Like now, you go buy a piece of land or you build your house in the mountains there in the Ozarks. It's like, man, I want a place where I have a beautiful view, or land actually has more value if you got a nice view and you can look down. And he said, people used to not talk like that. People were a lot more just functional. And so, you know, it makes sense. I mean, this is tough ground to just live in. I mean, to walk up to your dogs, you got to walk up the hill. Ben at Ben's house, I mean, it's just, you got to put your truck in four-wheel drive to get up his driveway half the time. I mean, it's just tough to live here. You know what I mean?
Well, we have a lot of first world problems now.
Yeah, that's right.
Our kids talk about the career they want, when our forefathers only wanted a job.
Right.
I mean, my papa worked at Pet Milk Company from the time he was 16 until he was 65. And was glad to just have a job. He didn't have the luxury of wanting a career.
Right, or choosing a career.
Oh, no. The choice was work or not eat, and they preferred to eat.
And he was happy and satisfied.
He was
with that.
One of the most content people I've ever known. And the principles that came out of that, I mean, just, I could sit here all day and talk about the things that him or my dad or some of the other old timers, you know, believed in. And just one example, when I would help my papa build fence, he wouldn't allow you to put your hands in your pockets. I mean, he could be down on his knees driving a staple in the barbed wire, and you were just waiting on him, you know, what he needed next. And if he caught me one day with my hands in my pockets, and I mean, just chewed me out royally. And he was not that kind of person. He wasn't one to chew people out. But it made him mad because he saw me standing there with my hands in my pockets, because in his mind, if he had got caught with his hands in his pockets coming out of the Depression, he could have lost his 50-cent-hour job because so many other people wanted it. And he didn't want me going to work.
Just the perception of being at work and having your hands in your pockets.
You did not put your hands in your pockets if somebody was working.
I see.
He'd say, watch me, watch what I'm doing and have what I need next.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then my dad was fanatical about taking care of equipment and stuff. I mean, if he bought something 20 years later, it would be as good a shape as it was when he bought it new because he grew up poor.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of things, you know, I have had it much better than my grandpa had it. I had it much better than my dad had it. And but I wouldn't trade how I grew up for for anything.
Yeah. Sometimes options aren't necessarily beneficial when you think about, like, all the options that we have now.
Yeah.
I mean, options in terms of career, where to live. I mean, like, like the prosperity of where we live, the time we live in, has given us a lot of options. I mean, even like what to have for dinner.
Who to marry. You know, 50, 60 years ago.
You had a smaller 75 circle.
75 years ago, you knew three girls down the road, and you married one of them. And you were happy, and you raised kids, and you built a home, and you had a job, and you stayed married for 70 years.
Mm.
And now you can use eHarmony.com and get all the stars to line up and can't last 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not about the process. It's the heart of the people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Options aren't always good.
No. That's a options long way
create,
from...
Options yeah. create a whole other set of issues, you know. But no. And I'll steer it right back into the bear hound world.
Yep.
And that it, as we close, and I'm going to give you, you can be thinking about this. I'm going to say, tell us a good bear hunting story to end it with. But this is what I was going to say, is that these mountain people that built these lines and strains of plots, and not just plots, any line of bear dogs, man, they didn't have the luxury of keeping a dog that wasn't producing game. They didn't have that luxury. And so if they had a dog, that dog had a purpose. If that dog didn't fulfill that purpose, it was gone. And so they yeah. had these, they developed the foundations of these excellent lines of dogs that had all the stuff. And then today, to me, it looks like, it feels like that we're kind of maybe have the option to even make that, some of those lines better by the options that we do have, because you can have a litter of pups. And this is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a litter of pups. That female has 9 puppies. You distribute those puppies to different people, and you're able to stay connected to those people just through technology, even if they live a long ways away. You're able to get reports on how they did. So you're able to negotiate a little bit and breed yeah. back into some better stuff maybe.
Well, back, you're talking about breeding. Back several years ago, Steve Fielder, before Facebook was a thing, Steve Fielder had one of the first plot websites, plotdogs.com. I was still in Montana at that time. And I wrote a thing on there, on Steve Fielder's website one time. It was pretty lengthy, but it was basically in praise of a good dog. And there was lots of talk at that time about who had the phenomenal, that was the word that was being used, who
right.
had the phenomenal dogs, who had them.
Yeah.
Because people were just starting to connect through social media.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to know what everybody else had.
Yeah.
So I wrote this thing that in praise of a good dog, because to me, when you're breeding dogs, what you're primarily looking for is not a phenomenon. Just by its very definition, a phenomenon is rare. If it wasn't rare, it wouldn't be a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So if you have a lot of phenomenons, it's now it's
I
normalized.
I understand now yeah. the title of your article, in praise of a good dog.
A good dog. Right.
Not a phenomenal dog.
Right.
Just a good dog.
Right. Now,
Got it.
What you're looking for, to me, in breeding is consistency. Over a period of generations, will your dogs catch what you want caught? We didn't quite finish that conversation, because people will talk of things about, like, a dog's mouth. Does it have a good mouth? Now, I don't personally like a silent trail dog, because I want to hear the race. That's the enjoyable part of hunting, is hearing the race.
Yeah.
So even if a silent dog is producing more, I still want to hear it.
Yeah.
Which I don't particularly think they catch anymore, but if a dog has a great mouth, but he's not catching game, then the mouth, it's like having a horn on a car with no engine.
Yeah.
It's an add-on. It's an extra. It's good.
Yeah.
But it's not the fundamental. But a lot of people are looking for the, like a tree dog. What if a dog trees 120 barks a minute?
But can't catch game.
What's the point of that dog? To me, he's right. useless. I mean, right. he's completely useless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, a bear dog, to me, we were talking about traits, the tree aspect on a bear dog is not how many barks a minute he puts off, but will he stay tree till I get there?
Yeah. Yeah.
If he will stay tree until you get there, that's a good tree dog.
So it doesn't matter if he's backed off the tree. I hear a lot of people talking about big game dogs, and they say, well, he's not a real good tree dog. He'll back off the tree and sit down and look up. And I even come from a coon hunting background, yeah. And I'm kind of like, well, as long as he's there and he's barking, well, it really doesn't matter if he's standing on the tree or not.
I can't speak for every bear hunter, but to me, I think some of that probably flows out of the coon dog vernacular, for belly sure. Rubbing tree dog and stuff.
Yeah.
A good tree dog to me, number one, is one that stays till I get there. Number two is one who barks till I get there. Don't have to be 120 barks a minute, but yep. He needs to keep barking.
Yep.
If it's 30 barks a minute, but he will do it for 6 hours if he's in a bad place.
Yeah.
That's
all you need.
That's fine. But backing off the tree, I like a dog that stays back off the tree. A lot of bear dogs will back up a bank so he can look straight across at the bear.
Mm-hmm.
And the good part about that to me, to some extent, is they stay out of trouble.
Right.
See, there's a misperception that bear dogs are ill. And that's totally backwards, because I'm not opposed to coon hunting. I'm for coon hunting. I enjoy it. You and I have talked about that this week. Yeah. But if you have an ill coon dog in today's world, you're hunting a woodlot, if you have trouble at the tree, you can be there in 10 minutes. If you have an ill bear dog at the tree, you might not be there for 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah.
Depending on how hard it is to get to the tree. Yeah. And if you've got an ill dog there, you just won't have dogs that are hurt. You'll have dogs that are dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you cannot allow an ill tree dog to be part of your pack at all. He cannot be ill. And a dog, if you hunt in mixed packs, like if you've got buddies you hunt with, or occasionally, you know, if you bear hunt, you're going to end up hunting with a stranger somewhere. And say he's got one that is a little rough on a tree. You know, I don't want mine, you know, fighting back and, you know, running the
other dog
off the tree.
Yeah, you don't want your dog in there jumping and running. If he's sitting back, he's staying out of trouble.
Back up, stay there till I get there, stay out of trouble.
And because, you know, on these bear trees, there's usually not going to be just one dog. There's going to be lots of dogs.
Yeah. Yep.
So just for people that aren't used to this bear hunting, like, you're turning a lot of dogs loose. But, well, hey, end us with can you think of an iconic bear hunting story from these mountains? If it's recent or old.
Yeah, before we get to that, you asked me if there was anything I wanted to say, just in general. Can I touch on that before
Absolutely.
The story? I'm an observer of people. And through social media, you get to observe a lot of people who hound hunt. And there's a few things that if I had the opportunity to say to people who were in hound hunting, then one of the things that I would say is this. It would be relax and learn to enjoy the experience as much as you enjoy the final product.
Mm-hmm.
Because your life is so short. And if you spend your hunting career mad about something, frustrated about something, tore all to pieces about something, fighting with other people, you're going to waste your life. And the whole purpose you're out there is to enjoy it. If it's not, we eat the meat, but you can buy beef. We're there for the experience.
Yeah.
So if you are the person who's ruining your own experiences because you can't deal with every little thing that happens, you're never going to – you probably ought to quit hound hunting. Because I grew up around people, some of them were wired up so strong that they hunted all their life, but I'm not sure they enjoyed it as much as other people. But my papaw, man, he enjoyed hunting as much as anybody. There was better bear hunters than Barry Tarleton, but nobody enjoyed it more.
Mm.
So I think he was the winner.
That's saying a lot right there.
So – learn to enjoy it. And the next thing I would say is this, is don't try to make your hounds an extension of who you are as a person in reference to your own pride.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some people that their whole life is built around what their dogs do. And what happens there is they end up, again, not enjoying it, and two, making life so difficult on their hounds that their hounds can't enjoy being hounds either. But, you know, you're who you are as a human being and what kind of person you are is going to tell a lot by the way you deal with others and the way you deal with hunting. And so, and then to go along with that is, and maybe this is the pastor coming out in me, if you don't mind me throwing this out there,
no.
If it's not too far off ground, is keep your hound hunting in its rightful place.
Right.
Prioritization. Yeah. I know people are not listening to this podcast because they want to hear me preach at them, but there are some things in this life that are more important. Your wife's more important.
Mm-hmm.
And your kids are more important. And I've seen a lot of destruction. And my grandpa, he tried to help some people along these lines. You know, if you'll keep it in its rightful place and in its rightful perspective, you can have a balanced life where you enjoy your hounds and your wife can enjoy you having your hounds. And your kids can enjoy you having those too.
Right.
And, you know, I know it's foolish to say this, but I see these memes that these boys put on Facebook that it'll show them throwing their girlfriend off a cliff. You know,
yeah.
She told me it was either me or the hounds, and you see her falling off a cliff.
Yep.
You know, I know there's probably some humor in that for a kid. But as a dad, if I look at that and that's my daughter going off the cliff, because some boy has that mentality toward my daughter,
yeah.
He's not the right guy.
Yeah.
There's no perspective whatsoever there.
Right.
And I say that because at some point, if that's all your life is, you're not going to be happy with that either. There's going to be no satisfaction for you in that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you said that because that's the key to life is balance and understanding priorities.
Yeah.
And I think it goes not just for hound hunters, but for anybody that is passionate about hunting or for really passionate about anything. But guys that are passionate about hunting can be eccentric and so focused on this one aspect of their life. That's great. You know, I'm glad you said that about the memes because I think that every time. I would never in my life post a meme or something like that. I mean, because obviously it might be funny, but there's truth behind what's being said and stuff like that.
Your
family's got to be your family. There's a lot. There's a lot that's in line above that. But and hound hunting is all encompassing. And I think that to somebody that's not been around the hound world, what Tracy's saying is true, to have 20 hounds in your backyard and to hunt those dogs and to breed those dogs and care for those dogs and to have them for decades kind of can be all encompassing. It can dominate your life.
It can. And family plays a major role in that deal there. And, which this is a totally different subject, but I'm reminded of it as we talk about these things, just random things, you know, that I would want to say about the whole matter is, and I said this at the supper table maybe last night, that states are trying to figure out how to get more kids into hunting because hunter numbers are dwindling.
Right.
There's very few bear hunters left in East Tennessee and Western North Carolina compared to what it was years ago. I mean, it's going downhill. They won't have to outlaw bear hunting. There ain't going to be nobody left to do it.
Hmm.
And I believe that part of the reason for that is because kids are being raised too soft. And I believe hunters are partly responsible for that. The men that I was raised around, I mean, they were good to me, and I tagged along with them, But they expected me as a kid, you know, to participate not just in the shooting, but also in the work. Leading the dogs, handling the dogs, helping the dogs, feeding the dogs, taking care of everything. You know, taking dogs in to the person who had found the track and so forth. And today what you see is the adults who are just obsessed with getting their 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid in there to shoot their first animal, when that kid has no clue what's taking place in the in the totality of things.
Yeah.
And once they've gone in and killed it, what's left for them?
Yeah.
I actually think we probably are not building the kind of kids that can be bear hunters now.
Yeah.
And it takes a certain kind of person, certain kind of mindset that can handle that day after day business of dealing with hounds and mountains and swamps and other things.
Yeah.
And and we're making things so easy on the kids, and we don't have any expectation for them to work hard and to do their part and to wait for the reward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's kind of the trend of modern culture that's brought itself into hunting, is that, hey, the way that we recruit these kids is we make it really easy for them. And I'm with you 100%. But we've got to have hunter recruitment. We've got to involve our kids. But, oh, man, I could do a whole podcast on what I've done with my kids. And I think I've made some mistakes, but I think I've also done some things right. But I'm 100% agreement with you on what you're saying. I mean, you got to make it. Hunting was hard for me growing up. Yeah. I know that. It was. My dad did not make it easy for us.
Sure.
And he kind of ran my brothers off from it in some ways. But that being said, it wasn't his fault. I mean, it just
this is an overt exaggeration just to prove a point. But the way I would maybe explain it is, you got kids that have killed multiple animals that couldn't tell you what a white oak was. Wouldn't know a white oak from a poplar. Yeah. They don't know anything about the woods. They don't know anything about the game. They are just handed the end result on a platter by people who have worked their whole life to get there.
It's a great example. Great example.
And I think they need to be told when they're young, son, this is important to our family. This is how we do our business. You help with the dogs. You lead things. You feed things. You take care of stuff.
You have some investment in it.
And at some point, it'll be right, and I'll let you know when.
Yeah. Yep. That's good. Well, hey, I'll give this offer to you again. Bear story.
All right.
End our podcast.
I think the one that I will mention is Ben, the first bear Ben got to kill, since we're talking about kids.
Mm-hmm.
We were living in Montana. I pastored out there, and in Montana at that time, you couldn't kill big game until you were 12. Mm. So we were going to be moving out of Montana in late fall, and the big game seasons were opening, and he had turned 12 the previous December, so I was able to get him started hunting. He killed his first mule deer buck, killed his first elk. I took him pheasant hunting. I had a nice English pointer. He went 3 for 3 on the first 3 pheasants that ever come up in front of him.
Mm.
And obviously, I was just tickled to death with that. And we moved back to Tennessee. And we got back here. And if I remember right, it was the last day of bear season. It was on a Wednesday. And I remember it was on a Wednesday because we went to church that night. And most people had already used their vacation up. The hunter numbers up on the mountain were, you know, pretty low. And it was me and Ben and my papaw. And at the time, he was like probably 78, 75, 78, somewhere out in there. I'd have to calculate that. Ben was 12, just getting ready to turn 13. And we was up on a place called Kennedy Cabin, and I walked out a trail called the Fire Scald. on the way out, I just had one dog with me. I was just looking to see if we could find something to turn loose. On the way out, I didn't find anything. Turned around and it's coming back and struck one red hot. So
it crossed, it crossed behind me.
So I called on the radio and I told Ben to bring me, I just think we had maybe four dogs with us that day, something like that. Told him to bring me the other dogs. Well, my papaw, who was in his upper 70s there, mid to upper 70s, came with him leading dogs. And just us three. And turned loose. The bear went down off the Camp Creek side of the mountain. I won't go into a lot of details because the listeners wouldn't know what I was talking about anyways, but it made a huge loop around the side of the mountain, turned and came back and crossed not far from where we had turned loose, dropped on the opposite side of the mountain, and we were still up on top. It just so happened that bear was going to try to cross the road headed toward North Carolina, and we had some friends that had come up behind us, and they were able to get block the road and get it turned, and it went back up the mountain. They packed on a few dogs there, and we got it treed. So we went down the road and came back up, and I went up to the tree. It was up on sort of a steep face, and I was at the base of the tree, and Ben had been brought in by my cousin Benny Laws and was with another man. I know Dolphus Cutchall was there. I know Bill Carter was there. And he was able to shoot the bear from the bottom, and he shot it with my dad had bought a Marlin lever action, and 35 Remington was his first rifle he bought in the early 70s. And I don't know how many bear dad had killed with that gun, several. And so Ben was able to kill his first bear with that same rifle, and that was probably my favorite day I've ever been in the woods.
Really?
Yeah.
Neat.
Of any hunting I've ever done, just because my grandfather, me, and now my son, we're all there together.
Right.
Yeah. Hunting the same dogs, you know, that I grew up with.
That's great.
Yep.
That's great. Well, hey, thank you so much for hosting me the last 2 days. I know if I'd been able to stay a little bit longer, we probably would have done better. 2 days is not much time.
Yeah. But
thank you so much for having us.
Great time. Appreciate you coming.
I'm really impressed with just everything you guys are doing. So, hey, thanks for listening to the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. Check out Bear Hunting Magazine. We're the only print bear hunting magazine in the world. We're on our 20th year.
Oh, man, yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Coming into 2019. We actually haven't, well, it's the 19th volume, but into the 20th year of Bear Hunting Magazine. And in this January, February issue, which we got to print 3 days ago, that's why I was able to come on this hunt. I had to get it to print. It went to print on Monday. It's a story of Tarleton's Houston Valley Cub, which was a dog that just passed away a month ago.
Yep.
And we did a legendary bear hound article on one of these Houston Valley dogs that was Ben and Tracy's, one of their favorite hounds. And so anyway, there's an article about that. You'll be able to read more. And so check out Bear Hunting Magazine. Check out our YouTube channel, as I always say, and keep the wild places wild, because that's where the bears live.